8:18 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Utah State Legislature begins on Monday, January 28th for its 45-day session. Besides personnel, public education receives one of the largest chunks of public funding every year. In the studio with her wish list for education funding and issues, I have the president of the Utah Education Association, Heidi Matthews, who was a Park City teacher here for years. Good morning to you, Heidi.
Good morning, Leslie.
So do you prepare a list of issues for state lawmakers?
We do. We have, as an organization, we establish a legislative platform, our kind of belief system of where we're going to focus our efforts, and we do that as a body during our kind of delegate assembly that we have each spring. And then from there, our UEA staff and government relations people come together and establish legislative priorities based on that platform and also based on the current environment and what's kind of shaping up to be the focus of the session.
Yeah, so who does that go to? All lawmakers, so they all have an idea of what, or does it just go to the education committee? Or
we share it far and wide. You know, this goes to our stakeholders, our members, our legislators. We use it in a survey that we send out to members to get kind of their input. We use it throughout our session just to kind of manage our message and stay focused.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what are the top priorities then for the Utah Education Association for 2019.
Well, we went about it a little bit differently this year in that in the past we've kind of looked at, you know, what do we need to do right now in order to address our most urgent needs, and that's only getting us so far. What we really need to do is look long term and big picture of what investments need to be made into education in order for us to be doing and fulfilling that promise for all of our students. And so this year, we really looked big and said, you know, we need to make significant investments in education so that our students have one-on-one attention that they deserve. So what does that look like? We can't move to a 15-to-1 class sizes in a year. In fact, that would take $1 billion just to do that in elementary school, and that doesn't even factor in buildings and physical spaces and desks and things like that. So clearly that's not reasonable, but moving in that direction, we ask for a 6.5% increase on the WPU, the weighted pupil unit. And that's a significant investment, but we see that the WPU is always the best way to get funds into our classrooms based on the specific needs of the individual districts.
So I don't know that it's ever gone over 4. Is that likely, a 6.5%?
I think it's more than likely. I think that it's necessary. I think that the citizens of Utah should demand this kind of investment. For years, our legislators and governor and everyone has been saying it, that we invest in education. I'm sorry. If we invest in the economy, we grow the economy, we will be able to invest in education. Well, we're there. Our economy has grown so much that there is $1.3 billion in excess, whatever that means, but for the legislature to be allotting this year. It's time to invest in education.
I think the governor's only recommending about a 4% increase in the WPU, and he's usually a little bit more generous than lawmakers are.
I would agree. When I look at some of the things that the governor has recommended, in addition to the 4% that he has recommended, he does outline specific investments for at-risk students. I think it's $30 million for counselors and social workers, for teacher bonuses. And what we're saying is take that entire amount and put it into the WPU, excuse me.
So any concern, voters turned down the gas tax in November, and that would have put in a bunch of money towards education. Any concerns and any regrets that you struck a deal with lawmakers to do it this way, other than moving forward with the Our Schools Now proposal, which would have, if passed, put in about $750 million, close to that $1 billion that you're talking about?
You know, that has been a tough one. As an education association, when we are We are asked to join with business leaders and stakeholders across the state in an investment in education. Of course, we're going to jump all over it. We worked really hard to shape the initiative, and we were really disappointed when it became convoluted and tied to the gas tax that really took the emphasis away from what we were fighting for, which is an investment in education, and it became a discussion of the mechanism. So yes, it was a disappointment, but understandable as well. It was very confusing to voters, and there wasn't a lot of trust that it was going to go where it needed. But the issues still remain, the needs still remain, and we now are in a situation in our state where we actually have the funds to be able to make these long-term investments. And this wasn't a question. Question one was not a question of support of education. It was a question of the mechanism and the gas tax. People support education. We recognize that if we want our students to succeed in this world, we have to make investments in their teachers so that they stay in the classroom. And we have the best and the brightest entering the field. They recognize that they must invest into education in order for all of our students to have access to a rich curriculum and not be overburdened by standardized tests. We must make those investments because it's our responsibility.
So do you think we'll see a return of the our schools now if you don't get the money you're looking for this year?
We're taking it one day at a time at this point. There's a national movement afoot for the Red for Ed investment in public education. And we have found in Utah that working collaboratively is far more successful than protesting or fighting. I think we made great grounds with the Our Schools Now initiative. That's something that really didn't come into play. But two-thirds of what we were asking for in the Our Schools Now initiative was made possible in the 2018 legislative session as a result of the compromise. So we made great grounds. We just didn't get that final piece.
Okay, so we talked about money. What are some of the other priorities for investment in education?
So at the Utah Education Association, again, we primarily focus on the WPU as the mechanism to have districts be able to decide what is the most important aspect of their in their local areas. But of course, salaries and compensation across the state are of significant interest in bolstering those so that we can begin to assuage this teacher shortage that we have. School safety, there are a number of issues that are, or bills that are up, one in particular that came out of the Utah School Safety Commission that I served on, Ray Ward's bill, that looks at making necessary investments so that there's wraparound services at the beginnings of concerns. There are questions of school grading that we are very interested in eliminating the single letter grade for a school that only serves to really punish and blame. We want resources to be invested in those schools that have the critical needs and maybe turn them into community schools where they have all the services that they need to be successful. And of course, we are really interested in some line item investments into investing in getting people into the teaching profession, into and through the profession, specifically focusing on an organization called Educators Rising, which is a group like FBLA or HOSA, the national organization where students meet and have a curriculum and have some competitions in the high school level. That would really, Educators Rising would really supplement what is happening in our CTE direction. Pathways with education and really investing in bolstering the image and the experience and getting people into our classrooms who are going to stay there.
Yeah, speaking about teachers, that was something UEA was against, was the way that was allowed to get teachers certified coming from outside the teaching career. How is that working out?
So what we were opposed to is eliminating the high standards and reducing the standards for what it means to become a teacher. I understand that not everyone needs to go through the traditional pathway of going through a university, but attending a university and having that rich background and pedagogy and the experiences that are monitored and supported is by far the best way to go. So that's what we have been supporting all along, is maintaining those standards. And what we are seeing is exactly what we anticipated seeing, is that if someone does not need to make that investment into a university experience, that they aren't necessarily going to do that. And so we have openings in our schools that are being filled with well-intentioned, really good people who are stepping up to a crisis, but who do not have the tools to be successful. And we find that these people are leaving the profession and leaving the classrooms at 2.5 times the rate. And so investing into teacher preparation, increasing the respect that the profession has, and providing opportunities like scholarships and grants to get people into especially our hardest to fill classrooms is going to pay off dramatically in terms of what our students will have in the long run, and the stability of the profession, which is an investment. I think it's $18,000 to bring a teacher up to speed in any district. And when you're having the turnover, like we're seeing, 40% leaving in the first 5 years, that gets pretty expensive too.
Yeah, so do lawmakers see that as a success? Or, I mean, because they've got teachers in the classroom, or do you think it'll change as a way to maintain, I mean, to retain the teachers?
Well, licensure is kind of a tricky thing. Some of it comes from the legislature, but most of it is established at the state board level. And so we just keep looking for ways that we can influence the quality of people coming into our classrooms, the support that they're getting, the resources that they need to stay, that isn't going to necessarily come through the formal licensure process.
Okay, and finally, just wanted, of course, the headlines today are teachers going on strike in Los Angeles. We saw that happen in Arizona last year. Is that something that actually could happen here?
Well, I think it's interesting, though, that this is the first strike in the Red for Ed movement that has been sweeping the country, of calling attention to public education funding. The other states like Arizona, Oklahoma, Kentucky, North Carolina, all of those states are right-to-work states like what we are here in Utah. So striking is not something that we would do here. That is not one of our options. The others were work actions. And I think anything is possible. Here in Utah, anything is possible. In Los Angeles, they are on strike for, yes, teacher compensation, a livable wage. But more importantly, they're on strike for class sizes so that the students can be known, for more counselors and librarians, because we love librarians, and social workers. And they're on strike so that the proliferation of charter schools can just stop and they can focus their resources on their district schools. They're on strike so that they can have arts and all of the things that we want here in Utah. I think they're leading the way, and we look to them and hope to raise our voices for these needs as well.
Yeah. Any winners, though, in a strike?
No. And it's not something that any teacher wants to do. I think that people do not strike, teachers do not strike because and take it lightly. This has been a long time in coming, and stalled discussions and stalled negotiations. And I think it's been a good 8 months in the process of getting to this point. We do see a lot of support for the teachers in Los Angeles, with communities coming together and parents and stakeholders really supporting them, because their goals are for our students.
I think they've been working out without a contract for about a year now, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Heidi, I need to leave it there. We'll check back with you during the session. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
APCW News Time now, 8:34. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council meeting on Tuesday this week, starting the meeting at 2 o'clock with a five-minute closed session, then jumping into interviews with the six applicants for two Planning Commission vacancies, one of which could be reappointed. In the studio with a preview of that and other items, I have Assistant City Manager Matt Dias along with Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Matt, what's with the five-minute closed session? I mean, your council's meeting in closed session after the Planning Commission interviews. I'm just curious, why before?
I obviously can't discuss what's in closed session, but I'm presuming it's just some sort of an organizational time so they can get their thoughts together before they begin the interview process. But I'm speculating. I'm actually not sure off the top of my head. I apologize.
So as council, I didn't see scheduled to make a decision on the Planning Commission applicants.
Yeah, and that's not atypical. What we've done in the past is typically interviewed all the candidates, and then the city council will come back at a future meeting and deliberate on their actual selections.
All right. During the regular meeting, the council will get the quarterly budget report for the second quarter. It shows that personnel, materials, budgets are underspent so far. In fact, it shows 33% of the total general fund budget has only 33% has been spent instead of 50%. So I guess if we're collecting money that is not getting spent, why not put some of this towards the treasure bond and help out the middle class a bit? I mean, that was one of the council's goals here.
So this budget report does have a lag in it. So that 33% of funds spent to date is a little bit misleading. There is a lag in the kind of actuals that are reported. Quarterly, we have a statutory authority that we have to provide a budgetary report to City Council, and we're fulfilling that. But I think you will see us at the next quarterly report, which will be our third quarter, have a better estimate of kind of revenues and expenditures to date and what the burn rate really is for operations, maintenance, and personnel.
Okay. Well, I mean, the second quarter ended December 31, so we're 2 weeks into. So
it,
you're
it
saying
did, but
that,
there,
that
but there is
that's
a lag,
not...
unfortunately.
Hmm. All right. Let's see. At the same time, planning, building, and engineering fee revenues has increased from fiscal year 18, so that means even more money coming in.
Yeah, and so obviously, we are actually only allowed to collect you know, we run a fee study every few years, and we typically try to only collect what it costs to pay for our inspectors and our plan reviewers. And so when the economy is better, we have more work, and, you know, our folks are working overtime, and I can say, you know, probably more work now than there probably was in even 2008 and 2009, right before the recession. So staff is working hard, and the fees that we collect go right back into the building department.
The council, during regular business, will consider a resolution authorizing the issuance of the $48 million in general obligation bonds. This is due to Park City voters approving that with a 77% of the vote in favor of that, adding about $200 to property owners with homes worth about $800,000, second homeowners and businesses paying 45% more than that. $16 million was reallocated from the budget to cover part of the cost of the bond, which we saw cuts with the planned public utilities building. The Main Street Plaza was cut, as well as other city repairs and improvements. Plus, we're not spending as much as has been budgeted for. So again, I mean, why go forward with $48 million here when it sounds like we've got some money?
Well, I guess I can't conclusively say that we have that money. And as I alluded to before, there is a lag in our accounting, which makes that sort of that burn rate seem lower than it will actually be. However, you know, we threw everything that we could as a municipality, we felt like, at the treasure bond. If you'll recall, you know, we even sold some land. We used deferred the brewpub project. We put $6 million down hard. And then, for instance, for example, we had $700,000 in savings from last year to this year. So actually, savings probably isn't the right word, but $700,000 where our revenues exceeded our expenditures. And so that money was diverted directly to the treasure purchase. So in the event that we can, you know, find other revenues and be creative, of course we would do that. I think for the benefit of the public, there are two significant financial items here. And first is the $48 million general obligation bond. And then the second is a sales tax revenue bond. And we're using both of these bonds to do three things. The first one's to sort of end the odyssey on the Treasure Hill open space purchase. The second is the commitment of $3 million towards Snow Ranch Armstrong excuse me, my voice, pastures. And the third is there is some money in here for affordable housing and workforce housing. So two financial instruments, three goals, Treasure, Snow Ridge, Pastures, and Armstrong, and the money towards affordable housing.
Okay. So of that $32 million for the sales tax revenue bonds, how much is going to Treasure and how much is going to housing?
So about $10 million towards Treasure and about $22 million towards affordable and workforce housing. And most of that's going to be used for the Woodside Phase 2 project that we've been working on for several, years now, almost.
So was this always intended, these additional sales tax revenue bonds?
It was, in fact.
To be used for Treasure.
No, excuse me, it was not. We have a 10-year plan for our additional resort community sales tax. And that 10-year plan was augmented in order to sort of do what you just said, which is to just put our money where our mouth is. We determined that this was a priority for us. And so we changed the 10-year plan and allocated resources towards Treasure.
Okay. Let's see. Voters appear to agree that prioritizing conservation and preservation is more important than development here. Yet, given the growth that we're seeing in the state of Utah, where will development be able to happen in Park City when we see this new growth?
It's probably good I have Bruce here, but I won't kick it to you right away, Bruce. But, we see the biggest and most purposeful places, perhaps, at the base of the resorts. I think that is the largest area of infill for us. By and large, we are predominantly built out when it comes to residential development. So the two big kind of keystone pieces that you will see will be at the Deer Valley Base and at Park City Mountain Resort Base. There'll obviously be some development with our Arts and Culture District, but that's what people should really see, I would say, in the next maybe 5 to 10 years, Bruce, is those two big properties, if and when they come in, will be the larger redevelopment projects in our community for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, but we're talking second homes in those locations now. We're talking about
big
hotels as opposed to...
The two projects at the base of the resort are going to be primarily resort-based. But I do think that you're seeing a trend where our resort-based housing becomes either second home or seasonal housing for the folks that can afford it. The other thing I would say is that any growth that comes to the community is probably going to be redevelopment, brownfield development. We don't see much more greenfield or new spaces for development. And honestly, Leslie, this whole prediction of growth is kind of a straight line calculation by the governor's Office of Economic Development. And so they plot a trend line and say, we're going to grow. Well, we don't know where the jobs are. We don't know about the transportation infrastructure. We don't know the effects of the new international port at the airport. We don't understand the effects of growth over at Mayflower. So there's some other components to just building houses that our community needs to consider.
Okay. Moving on, Matt, the council will consider the proposed 2019 legislative platform policy guidelines. Are we talking state legislature or are we talking just the council's priorities for the year?
So a little bit of both, to be honest. This, I believe, is the third year that we've done this. As folks know, we have a very compressed legislative session here. It's about 45 days, and that has various pros and cons. I mean, obviously the pros, it has everyone's attention and everyone is focused on it at once. I can reach out at my counterparts at the school district, for example, or at the county, at the chamber, and we're all working on the same thing. The cons are it is so compressed that a lot happens quickly and a lot can be lost. So what we do is we have a legislative platform, which are some guiding principles that council have about being revenue sort of independent from the state, no unfunded mandates, various kind of components, because I often, in myself and staff and the mayor and other council members, don't have time to get back to city council. Let's say for a Thursday night meeting, if the mayor has to testify on Monday, or we have to go down with three council members and lobby the state delegation. So what we did to get ahead of that is we came up with a platform that we could all agree upon with some fundamental tenets. And then obviously we report back in at the earliest opportunity if we took any activity at the Capitol.
Yeah, it looks like we've got some language referring to social equity. So what legislation does that look like?
Well, it could look like, it runs the gamut. It could look like affordable housing legislation. It could look like some legislation having to do with homelessness or a homeless fee. There have been all sorts of there's been all sorts of things happening the last couple of years, I think, as Utah grows and develops and is dealing with some of the challenges that accompany these things. So we thought, because it was our kind of one of our new critical priorities, that it needed to be included, and that was a recommendation out of council last year when I had the platform approved. And so we redlined that in the staff report, so if the public's interested, we wanted to make sure that we followed up on that council request and added that component.
Okay, Bruce, let's talk a little bit about the land management code amendments. We're dealing mostly, I think, with the historic district. What's council being asked to approve?
Well, there's two things going on, and the first one is Anya Gron and Hannah Tyler have put together over a decade's worth of work of a rewrite of the historic district guidelines to make them more clear, more easily understandable by the general public, and more easy to regulate. So it's 10 years worth of work in 6 years for those folks, and this is the final outcome. It's probably two dozen historic preservation board meetings and half a dozen planning commission meetings to get this thing to this point in order to get it into the land management code. So no real hyper changes in the historic district, but a whole bunch of clarity.
Okay, so simpler to understand?
Simpler, well, nothing simple in the historic district, but yes, as simple as we can make it. And especially because Anya and Hannah are so good at doing the regulations that they see questions dozens of times a week over certain matters. So they've tried to clear all that up and make their job better and make the public's understanding of the historic better.
Yeah, so what does it do to flat roofs? Anything?
Oh, yeah. Well, flat roofs have already been kind of gone for about the last year now in the historic district, except in the commercial business district. So that section of the code was approved last year. This isn't changing that. This is affecting things like railing heights and window treatments, the amount of excavation you can do around a historic house. They've clarified some of the historic district requirements for material deconstruction. But mainly it's a huge, huge cleanup.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to add?
If you have one more minute, tomorrow night or Wednesday night is Anya Gron's last historic preservation board meeting. She's leaving us to go to North Carolina to take on a preservation role on the East Coast. We will desperately miss her. And we're very, very proud of the work that she's done. Hannah Tyler will be taking over as senior planner on the 17th.
Okay. Bruce, Matt, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
KPCW News Time now, 8:46. KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Good morning. Well, bad weather forced the delay of the long-anticipated return of Lindsey Vonn to the Alpine World Cup. In studio with an update of that, as well as some other ski and snowboard news, I have team spokesman Tom Webb. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So it was what? Austria where the snow?
Yes. Anybody who's been keeping an eye on weather reports from Europe will see there has been some extremely heavy snowfalls over there, much more than they've been used to for a while. So unfortunately, yeah, that meant the cancellation of the St. Anton race, which Lindsey had announced a few days before that she would be returning to. So I think the main thing for us is obviously good news that she's back on snow, back racing. Accident that she had over in Copper was pretty bad. It looked pretty bad. Obviously not as bad as it could have been, but we're delighted to see her back on snow and therefore getting back to this chase for this world record title of 86 wins.
Yeah, so Super G and downhill is what she'll be competing in?
Yeah, I think that's TBC. We'll find out. I mean, obviously she is she's the greatest downhill female skier of all time, so I think she'll be focused on that, but we'll see what else she's doing when she gets into Cortina, which is where we expect to see her next on snow.
Okay. Let's see. On the men's side of the Alpine World Cup, Tommy Ford doing pretty well in his GS.
Yeah. So Tommy got himself a sixth place. That's easy for me to say, in Adelboden in Switzerland. Tommy's having a really good season. I think there's a number of those male athletes who maybe are making some amends for what happened in the Olympic Games. And maybe some of the results that we'd been targeting over the last few years haven't been quite up there. But there's a strong focus on developing talent, but also making sure that we can continue to support guys like Tommy. So, yeah, a sixth place there was good. Also, some points for local boy Ted Ligety. Ted's having a bit of a struggle this season. He actually said himself that he's kind of stuck in a little vicious cycle at the moment, but he's still registering points. And, you know, with the experience and knowledge that he's got, I don't think anybody's going to write off somebody like Ted Ligety's chances of getting himself back on a podium and even a World Cup win. And Obviously, we've got World Championships coming up in Oray in February, so there's going to be a lot of attention on that. And who knows, we would very much like to see Ted and his colleagues be able to put in some very solid results there.
Okay. Let's see. Alex Hall from Park City won.
Yeah, so Alex, a free ski athlete, another local boy, claimed his podium place in Fort Romeo in France in Saturday. That's his second ever World Cup win. So really good preparations for the World Championships, and a good to see another local boy putting in solid results before we head to the biggest events here in Park City since the 2002 Winter Olympic Games. Biggest sports events, I should say.
Yeah. So have the teams been named for World Championships?
No, we're actually going to be leaving the naming of the teams till very close to the date of the event, because there's a number of World Cup events and qualifying events that take place between now and then. So we're aiming to name the full teams on the 29th of January. So anybody who wants to know who's going to be competing, look out then. We are very lucky because we got a couple of defending world champions in John Lillis and Ashley Caldwell in aerials. We've got Lindsay Jacobellis in snowboard cross. So when normally we'd have a limit of maybe four team members per sports discipline, where we've got defending world champions, we actually get an extra slot. So we have an even better chance for up-and-coming athletes to get their place in those World Championships. But yeah, we're going to leave it as close as possible to the actual events so that we can have the strongest team out there competing.
Okay, let's see. Freestyle, we had the moguls competition taking place.
Yeah, so Jaylen Kauf, again, continuing that really good season for her. She's having a fantastic battle with Perrine Lafont from France. She put herself up into third place, just 3 points behind her rival in the World Cup season so far. Again, that's another really good result. I think anticipation is growing for that freestyle event that's going to be taking place up at Deer Valley in a few short weeks. And knowing that Jaylen's going in there in really good form is extremely strong for us. Her teammates, Brad Wilson, Tess Johnson, the Andringas, there's a whole bunch of other guys and girls on that team who are doing really well. So yeah, we're very, very pleased about that. It's been a very busy weekend, but when we get to report podiums and strong competition from people like Jaylen, it makes it all worth it.
Okay. And cross country also saw some good results there.
Yeah. So over in Germany, Sophie Caldwell had two very smart sprint heats and took fifth place at the Cross Country World Cup in Dresden. And then on Sunday in the team sprint, Sophie and Julia Ken finished fourth. So yeah, again, another good result. There's obviously a lot of focus on Jessie Diggins in that team because of the gold medal that she and Keegan won back in February. But we're seeing really strong results from across the board in that team. So very, very happy with what they're doing at the moment.
Okay, and then finally in snowboard, what do we got there?
Yeah, Chris Corning from Silverthorne claimed his first World Cup slopestyle podium of the season in Kreuzberg in Austria in the Snowboard World Cup. So that's snowboard and free ski and freestyle, which are all part of the same team at US Ski and Snowboard. All people from those teams, all registering podiums. I don't know the exact number of podiums that we've got so far this season, but our chief of athletics, Luke Bodensteiner, told us last week we got 45 World Cup podiums already this season. That is an incredibly good number. And I think, you know, when we look at particularly World Championships taking place here on home soil, I think we're hoping to smash previous records. It would be a big target, but I think with the success rate that we're seeing, that's totally achievable.
Yeah, so does that basically guarantee Chris getting a spot on the team?
I'm never going to say guarantee because injuries obviously always play a role in that. But yeah, I think Chris is looking pretty strong to be able to nail his place in for the events in February. But again, January 29th, keep an eye out then, and we'll be making sure everybody knows who's competing.
Okay, Tom, anything else?
No, that's it. Right. Have a great week.
Thanks. It's Tom Webb with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Sure. Well, the Park City Education Foundation recently awarded its teachers' grants. In studio with details, I have the foundation's director, Abby McNulty, along with one of the volunteers on the Teacher Grant Committee and PCEA. EF board member Jody Fay. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Abby, we'll start with you and just maybe give us a quick background of teachers' grants. I mean, as I remember, it was way back in the mid-80s when teacher grants really kind of started the whole
foundation. Yeah, that's right. It was the kickstart to the Education Foundation. A $2,000 grant was given to two students to travel to a space camp at Stanford. And so it's, you know, we like to say it's sort of the heart and soul of the Education Foundation. And we've been issuing the teacher grants ever since, some 32 years later.
Okay, so we've gone from $2,000 to what this year?
This year, our teacher grants awarded $75,000 to teachers throughout the school district.
And how does that compare with prior years?
Well, every year we have about the same amount of money to distribute to teachers through this program. What changes a little bit are the themes that come in. We see themes every year of what's being requested and also the number of requests. So we gave we funded about 28 grants, and we had about 50 grants come in to the organization. And we have a team of board members and community members who gather for about 3 hours all together and then invest additional hours prior to that reading the grants to make decisions.
Yeah. Talk to Jody in just a minute about that. But the so is this all new money that you raise every year, or is
it
an endowment that you get to pull from?
We have two endowments that fund very specific grants that are small portions. It's about, it's about $5,000 total of the $75,000. And then we raise the money every year. Actually, like all Education Foundation funded programs, we raise the money every year. But we're so lucky we have generous support from Deer Valley and from the Fay Family Foundation. And this year we had a generous donation from an anonymous donor as well.
Great. So Jody, you're part of that Fay Family Foundation. This is something I think that the foundation grants every year. Why in particular teacher grants?
When I started on the Ed Foundation 4 years ago, I wasn't sure what committee to sign up for, and Abby suggested Teacher Grant Committee. And I went, I read the applications, and I was stunned by how little money we had to give and the quantity of asks that were out there. And I ended up going to my family's foundation and saying to them, you have no idea the need in our classrooms. Is there any way we can help? So that's how it started.
Okay. Yeah. So you're part of that committee then that decides out of the 50 grants, which 28 got them this coming year. So how do you choose?
Well, we had over $150,000 in asks and only $75,000 to give. So it is not easy. We read, we talk about it. We have representatives from every school there, as well as community members and parents who have gone through the school so they understand the programs. And we partially fund some and fully fund as many as we can to help the teachers.
Okay.
That's what they're looking for. Yeah.
Any particular favorites this year?
Yes. Well, just an example of how a little bit of money goes a long way. Andrea Solom at Ecker asked for $250, which we funded for an ELA escape room. So she's creating an ELA escape room and giving the kids a different way of learning and presenting just a different opportunity with only $250. Then another one I loved was Treasure Mountain is getting their first STEM room, a maker space. Mm-hmm. Every other school had a maker space. Treasure Mountain has been put on hold because for years it was, let's see if we pass our bond. Then the bond didn't fail. Then it's been, now we can't do anything, so we don't know what's going to happen to the building. And Emily, the principal over there, wrote a phenomenal grant saying our kids deserve this, and it's at every other school. And so we were able to fund $15,000 and give them their first room.
Yeah. It's really exciting.
So crowding is an issue there. So is it they're making way a room for the room, or
they're taking part of their library, and a maker space is a room that the elementary schools have. Ecker, we funded through teacher grants 2 years ago, and then last year as well, we gave them additional money where kids who aren't interested in going out and playing sports on the playground, who maybe want to do tinkering, who want to do electronics, want to do something else, it gives them a different escape. And so that's what Treasure's finally getting. They were the last school.
Okay. Any other projects you wanted to highlight?
Jeremy Ranch got a coffee cart, which is great. The other schools also had that. Coffee cart is for kids who maybe need to work on their language skills a little bit more and social skills, and they get to go around the school and ask teachers their coffee orders, take their coffee orders, and make coffee for them.
It's very cool. And I will say, too, that the Education Foundation teacher grants fund innovation, but new in recent years, we also fund the expansion of grants that are working in other schools. And so the coffee cart is an example of that.
Okay. So these programs will get put into place this school year?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. They should be getting going right now, actually.
Okay. Because the money was handed out, what, just before?
Just before break.
Holiday mm-hmm. break.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Anything else you wanted to add?
That's it. Thank you so much. And thank you to all of our committee members who spent hours making these really tough decisions, and to all the teachers who took time to apply.
Okay. Jody Fay and Abby McNulty, thanks for your time.